The cupola atop Moses Richardson's barn was explosively hot. Sweat had been trickling down her body by the time they got to the hayloft, but by the time they reached the top of the rickety flight of stairs leading from the loft to the cupola, it was rivering down her, darkening her blouse and molding it to her breasts. "Do you really think this is necessary, Harold?" "I don't know." He was carrying a bucket of white paint and a wide brush with the protective cellophane still on it. "But the barn overlooks U.S. 1, and that's the way most people would come, I think. Anyway, it can't hurt." "It will hurt if you fall off and break your bones." The heat was making her headache, and her lunchtime Coke was sloshing around her stomach in a way that was extremely nauseating. "In fact, it would be the end of you." "I won't fall," Harold said nervously. He glanced at her. "Fran, you look sick." "It's the heat," she said faintly. "Then go downstairs, for goodness sake. Lie under a tree. Watch the human fly as he does his death-defying act on the precipitous 10-degree slope of Moses Richardson's barn roof." "Don't joke. I still think it's silly and dangerous." "Yes, but I'll feel better if I go through with it. Go on, Fran." She thought, why, he's doing it for me. He stood there, sweaty and scared, old cobwebs clinging to his naked, blubbery shoulders, his belly cascading over the waistband of his tight blue jeans, determined not to miss a bet to do all the right things. She stood on tiptoe and kissed his mouth lightly. "You be careful," she said, and then went quickly down the stairs with the Coke sloshing in her belly. Up, down, all around. Yuck. She went quickly, but not so quickly that she didn't see the stunned happiness come up in his eyes. She went down the nailed rungs from the hayloft to the straw-littered barn floor even faster, because she knew she was going to puke now. And while she knew that it was the heat and the Coke and the baby, what might Harold think if he heard? So she just wanted to get outside where he couldn't hear. And she made it. Just. Harold came down at 3:45, his sunburn now flaming red, his arms splattered with white paint. Fran had napped uneasily under an elm in Richardson's dooryard while he worked, never quite going under completely, listening for the rattle of shingles giving way and poor fat Harold's despairing scream as he fell the 90 feet from the barn's roof to the hard ground below. But it never came, thank God, and now he stood proudly before her, lawn green feet, white arms, red shoulders. They both gazed up at the barn roof. The fresh paint gleamed out sharp contrast to the faded green shingles, and the words painted there reminded Fran of the signs you sometimes came upon down south, painted across barn roofs. "Jesus Saves," or "Chew Red Indian." Harold's read, "Have gone to Stovington, Vermont, Plague Center, U.S. 1 to Wells, Interstate 95 to Portland, U.S. 302 to Barry, Interstate 89 to Stovington. Leaving Ogunquit July 2, 1980. Harold Emery Lauder, Francis Goldsmith." "I didn't know your middle name," Harold said apologetically. "That's fine," Franny said, still looking up at the sign. The first line had been written just below the cupola window, the last, her name, just above the rain gutter. "How did you get that last line on?" she asked. "It wasn't hard," he said self-consciously. "I had to dangle my feet over a little, that's all." "Oh, Harold, why couldn't you have just signed for yourself?" "Because we're a team," he said, and then looked at her a little apprehensively. "Aren't we?" "I guess we are, as long as you don't kill yourself." "Hungry?" He beamed. "Hungry as a bear." "Then let's go eat. And I'll put some baby oil on your sunburn. You're just going to have to wear your shirt, Harold. You won't be able to sleep on that tonight." "I'll sleep fine," he said, and smiled at her. Franny smiled back. They ate a supper of canned food and Kool-Aid. Franny made it and added sugar. And later, when it had begun to get dark, Harold came over to Fran's house with something under his arm. "It was Amy's," he said. "I found it in the attic. I think Mom and Dad gave it to her when she graduated from junior high. I don't even know if it still works, but I got some batteries from the hardware store." He patted his pockets, which were bulging with ever-ready batteries. It was a portable phonograph, the kind with the plastic cover, invented for teenage girls of 13 or 14 to take to beach and lawn parties, the kind of phonograph constructed with 45 singles in mind, the ones made by the Osmonds, Leif Garrett, John Travolta, Sean Cassidy. She looked at it closely and felt her eyes filling with tears. "Well," she said, "let's see." It did work, and for almost 4 hours they sat at the opposite ends of the couch, the portable phonograph on the coffee table before them, their faces waxed with silent and sorrowful fascination, listening as the music of a dead world filled the summer night. Chapter 29. At first, Stu accepted the sound without question. It was such a typical part of a bright summer morning. He had just passed through South Reigate, New Hampshire, and now the highway wound through a pretty country of overhanging elms that dappled the road with coins of moving sunlight. The underbrush on either side was thick, bright sumac, blue-gray juniper, lots of bushes he couldn't name. The profusion of them was still a wonder to his eyes. On the left, an ancient rock wall meandered in and out of the brush, and on the right a small brook gurgled cheerily east. Every now and then, small animals would move in the underbrush. Yesterday, he had been transfixed by the sight of a large doe standing on the white line of 302, scenting the morning air. And birds called raucously. And against that background of sound, the barking dog sounded like the most natural thing in the world. He walked almost another mile before it occurred to him that the dog, closer now by the sound, might be out of the ordinary after all. He had seen a great many dead dogs since leaving Stovington, but no live ones. Well, he supposed, the flu had killed most, but not all of the people. Apparently, it had killed most, but not all of the dogs as well. Probably, it would be extremely people-shy by now. When it scented him, it would most likely crawl back into the bushes and bark hysterically at him until Stu left its territory. He adjusted the straps of the Day-Glo pack he was wearing, and refolded the handkerchiefs that lay under the straps of each shoulder. He was wearing a pair of Georgia Giants, and 3 days of walking had rubbed most of the new from them. On his head was a jaunty, wide-brimmed red felt hat, and there was an army carbine slung across his shoulder. He did not expect to run across marauders, but he had a vague idea that it might be a good idea to have a gun. Fresh meat, maybe. Although when he had seen the deer yesterday, he had been too amazed and pleased to even think about shooting it. The pack riding easily again, he went on up the road. The dog sounded like it was just beyond the next bend. Maybe I'll see him after all, Stu thought. He had picked up 302 going east because he supposed that sooner or later it would take him to the ocean. He had made a kind of compact with himself. When I get to the ocean, I'll decide what I'm going to do. Until then, I won't think about it at all. His walk, now in its fourth day, had been a kind of healing process. He had thought about taking a 10-speed bike or maybe a motorcycle that he could push around the occasional crashes that blocked the road, but instead had decided to walk. He had always enjoyed hiking, and his body cried out for exercise. Until his escape from Stovington, he had been cooped up for nearly 2 weeks, and he felt flabby and out of shape. He supposed that sooner or later his slow progress would make him impatient, and he would get the bike or motorcycle, but for now he was content to hike east on this road, looking at whatever he wanted to look at, taking 5 when he wanted to, or in the afternoon dropping off for a snooze during the hottest part of the day. It was good for him to be doing this. Little by little, the lunatic search for a way out was fading into memory, just something that had happened instead of a thing so vivid it brought cold sweat out onto his skin. The memory of that feeling of someone following him had been the hardest to shake. The first 2 nights on the road, he had dreamed again and again of his final encounter with Elder, when Elder had come to carry out his orders. In the dreams, Stu was always too slow with the chair. Elder stepped back out of its arc, pulled the trigger of his pistol, and Stu felt a heavy but painless thump in the middle of his chest, as if he had been hit by a thrown boxing glove weighted with lead shot. Over and over until he woke unrested in the morning, but so glad to be alive that he hardly realized it. Last night the dreams hadn't come. He doubted if they would stop all at once, but he thought he might be walking the poison out of his system, little by little. He came around the bend, and there was the dog, an auburn-colored Irish setter. It barked joyously at the sight of Stu and ran up the road, toenails clicking on the composition surface, tail wagging frantically back and forth. It jumped up, placing its forepaws on Stu's belly, and its forward motion made him stagger back a step. "Whoa, boy," he said, grinning. The dog barked happily at the sound of his voice and leaped up again. "Kojak," a stern voice said, and Stu jumped and stared around. "Get down. Leave that man alone. You're going to track all over his shirt, miserable dog." Kojak put all 4 feet on the road again and walked around Stu with his tail between his legs. The tail was still wagging in suppressed joy, however, and Stu decided this one would never make much of a canine put-on artist. Now he could see the owner of the voice, and of Kojak, it seemed like. A man of about 60, wearing a ragged sweater, old gray pants, and a beret. He was sitting on a piano stool and holding a palette, an easel with a canvas on it stood before him. Now he stood up, placed the palette on the piano stool. Under his breath, Stu heard him mutter, "Now don't forget and sit on that," and walked toward Stu with his hand extended. Beneath the beret, his fluffy grayish hair bounced in a small and mellow breeze. "I hope you intend no foul play with that rifle, sir. Glenn Bateman at your service." Stu took the outstretched hand. "Stuart Redman, don't worry about the gun." "Do you like caviar?" "Never tried it." "Then it's time you did. And if you don't care for it, there's plenty of other things. Kojak, don't jump. I know you're thinking of renewing your crazed leaps. I can read you like a book, but control yourself. Always remember, Kojak, that control is what separates the higher orders from the lower. Control." His better nature thus appealed to, Kojak shrank down on his haunches and began to pant. "I'm inviting you to lunch," Bateman said. "You're the first human being I've seen in nearly a week. Will you stay?" "I'd be glad to." "Southerner, aren't you?" "East Texas." Bateman nodded and turned back to his picture, an indifferent watercolor of the woods across the road. He headed toward the piano stool. "I wouldn't sit there," Stu said hastily. "No, it wouldn't do, would it? Thank you." He changed course and headed toward the back of the small clearing. Stu saw there was an orange and white cooler chest in the shade back there, with what looked like a white lawn tablecloth folded on top of it. When Bateman fluffed it out, Stu saw that was what it was. "Used to be part of the communion set at the Grace Baptist Church in Woodsville," Bateman said. "I liberated it. I don't think the Baptists will miss it. They've all gone home to Jesus. At least all the Woodsville Baptists have. What we have here is one old pagan communing with nature instead. Kojak, don't step on the tablecloth. Control. Always remember that, Kojak. In all you do, make control your watchword. Shall we step across the road and have a wash, Mr. Redman?" "Make it stew." "All right, I will." They went across the road and washed in the cold, clear water. Downstream from them, Kojak lapped at the water and then bounded off into the woods, barking happily. He flushed a wood pheasant, and Stu watched it explode up from the brush and thought with some surprise that just maybe everything would be all right. Somehow all right. He didn't care much for the caviar. It tasted like cold fish jelly. But Bateman also had a pepperoni, a salami, 2 tins of sardines, some slightly mushy apples, and a large box of Keebler fig bars. Stu ate hugely. During the meal, which was eaten largely on saltines, Bateman told Stu he had been an assistant professor of sociology at Woodsville Community College. His wife had been dead 10 years. They had been childless. Most of his colleagues had not cared for him, he said, and the feeling had been heartily mutual. "They thought I was a lunatic," he said. "The strong possibility that they were right did nothing to improve our relations." As he divided the dessert, a Sara Lee pound cake, and handed Stu his half on a paper plate, he said, "I'm a horrible painter, horrible. But I simply tell myself that this July there is no one on earth painting better landscapes than Glendon Pequod Bateman, BAMAMFA. A cheap ego trip, but mine own." "Was Kojak your dog before?" "No, Kojak belonged to the woman around the corner from me. We both lived, along with a great deal of the faculty. in a development called College Hill. She was a miserable, opinionated woman. She died, and her dog lived, which gives lie to the idea that there is no justice in the world. Excuse me for a minute, Stu. He trotted across the road, and Stu heard him splashing in the water. He came back shortly, pants legs rolled to his knees. He was carrying a dripping six-pack of Narragansett beer in each hand. This was supposed to go with the meal, stupid of me. It goes just as well after, Stu said, pulling a can off the template. Thanks. They pulled their ring tabs, and Bateman raised his can. To us, Stu, may we have happy days, satisfied minds, and little or no low back pain. Amen to that. They clicked their cans together and drank. Stu thought that a swallow of beer had never tasted so good to him before, and probably never would again. You're a man of few words, Bateman said. I hope you don't feel that I'm dancing on the grave of the world, so to speak. No, Stu said. I am dancing on the grave of the world, now that I stop to think about it, Glenn Bateman said. It's not really the end, Stu said. At least I don't think so. Just intermission. Rather apt. Well said. I'm going back to my picture, if you don't mind. Go ahead. Have you seen any other dogs? No. Nor have I. You're the only other person I've seen, but Kojak seems to be one of a kind. If he's alive, there will be others. Not very scientific, Bateman said kindly. What kind of an American are you? Show me a second dog, preferably a bitch, and I'll accept your thesis that somewhere there is a third. But don't show me one and from that posit a second. It won't do. I've seen cows, Stu said thoughtfully. Cows, yes, and deer, but the horses are all dead. You know that's right, Stu agreed. He had seen several dead horses on his walk. In some cases, cows had been grazing upwind of the bloating bodies. Now, why should that be? No idea. We all respire in much the same way, and this seems primarily to be a respiratory disease. But I wonder if there isn't some other factor. Men, dogs, and horses catch it. Cows and deer don't. And rats were down for a while, but now seem to be coming back. Bateman was recklessly mixing paint on his palette. Cats everywhere, a plague of cats. None of it makes any surface sense. It's crazy. It sure is, Stu said, and uncorked another beer. His head was buzzing pleasantly. We're apt to see some interesting shifts in the ecology, Bateman said. He was making the horrible mistake of trying to paint Kojak into his picture. Remains to be seen if Homo sapiens is going to be able to reproduce himself in the wake of this. It very much remains to be seen, but at least we can get together and try. But is Kojak going to find a mate? Is he ever going to become a proud papa? Jesus, I guess he might not. Bateman got a fresh beer. I think you're right, he said. There probably are other people, other dogs, other horses, but many of the animals may die without ever reproducing. There may be some animals of those susceptible species who were pregnant when the flu came along, of course. I'm sure there are dozens of healthy women in the United States right now who, pardon the crudity, have cakes baking in the oven. But some of the animals are apt to just sink below the point of no return. If you take dogs out of the equation, the deer, who seem immune, are going to run wild. Certainly there aren't enough men left around to keep the population down. Hunting season is going to be canceled for a few years. Well, Stu said, the surplus deer will just starve. No, they won't. Not up here, anyway. I can't speak for what might happen in East Texas, but in New England, all the gardens were planted and growing nicely before this flu happened. The deer will have plenty to eat this year and next. Even after that, our crops will germinate wild. There won't be any starving deer for maybe as long as 7 years. If you come back this way in a few years, Stu, you'll have to elbow deer out of your way to get up the road. What did you mean when you said whether or not people could reproduce themselves was open to question? There are two possibilities, Bateman said, at least two that I see right now. The first is that the babies may not be immune. You mean, die as soon as they get into the world? Yes, or possibly in utero. Less likely, but still possible, the superflu may have some sterility effect on those of us that are left. That's crazy, Stu said. Sure, so's the mumps, Glenn Bateman said dryly. But if the mothers of the babies that are, in utero, if the mothers are immune... Yes, immunities can be passed on, mother to child, just as susceptibilities can. But you just can't bank on it. I think the future of babies now in utero is very uncertain. Their mothers are immune, granted, but statistical probability says that most of the fathers were not, and are now dead. What's the other possibility? That we may finish the job of destroying ourselves, Bateman said calmly. Not right away, because we're all too scattered. But man is a gregarious social animal, and eventually we'll get back together. Most of the societies that form are apt to be primitive dictatorships run by little Caesars, unless we're very lucky. A few may be enlightened, democratic communities, and I'll tell you exactly what the necessary requirement for that kind of society in the 1980s and 90s is going to be. A community with enough technical people in it to get the lights back on. Stu sipped his beer. Think so? Sure. Now let me give you a hypothetical situation, Mr. Stuart Redman from East Texas. Suppose we have Community A in Boston and Community B in Utica, New York. Society A is in good shape. They are living on Beacon Hill in the lap of luxury because one of their members is an electrical technician. This man knows just enough to get the Beacon Hill power plant running again. It would mostly be a matter of knowing which switches to pull when the plant went into an automatic shutdown. So in Boston, the juice is flowing. There's heat against the cold, light so you can read at night, refrigeration so you can have your scotch on the rocks like a civilized man. In fact, life is pretty damn near idyllic. No pollution, drug problem, race problem, shortage problem. No money or barter problem, because all the goods, if not the services, are out on display, and there are enough of them to last a radically reduced society for 3 centuries. But Community B up there in Utica, there's no one to run the power plant. It's going to take a long time for them to figure out how to make it go again. In the meantime, they're cold at night. They're eating out of cans. They're miserable. A strong man takes over. They're glad to have him because they're confused and cold and sick. He sends someone to Boston with a request. Will they send their technician up to Utica to help them get their power plant going again? The alternative is a long and dangerous move south for the winter. So what does Community A do when they get this message? Send the guy? Stu asked. Christ, no. He may be held against his will. In fact, it would be extremely likely. In the post-flu world, technological know-how is going to replace gold as the most perfect medium of exchange. And in those terms, Society A is rich and Society B is poor. So what does Society B do? I guess they go south, Stu said. Maybe even to East Texas. Maybe. Or maybe they threaten the Boston people with a nuclear warhead. Right, Stu said. They can't get their power plant going, but they can explode an A-bomb. Bateman said, If I had the bomb, I'd simply pile several crates of dynamite around it and try to detonate it that way. Would that work? Dogged if I know. Even if it didn't, there are plenty of conventional weapons around. That's the point. All of that stuff is lying around, waiting to be picked up. And if communities A and B both have pet technicians, they might work up some kind of rusty nuclear exchange over religion or territoriality or some paltry ideological difference. Just think, instead of 6 or 7 world nuclear powers, we may end up with 60 or 70 of them right here in the continental United States. A silence fell between them. Far off, they could hear Kojak barking in the woods as the day turned on its noontime axis. You know, Bateman said finally, I'm fundamentally a cheerful man. Maybe because I have a low threshold of satisfaction. Eccentric but cheerful, that's me. The only bane of my life has been my dreams. Ever since boyhood, I've been plagued by amazingly vivid dreams. A lot of them have been nasty. As a youngster, it was trolls under bridges that reached up and grabbed my foot, or a witch that turned me into a bird. Do you ever have bad dreams, Stu? Sometimes, Stu said, thinking of Elder, and how Elder lurched after him in his nightmares, and of the corridors that never ended but only switched back on themselves, lit by cold fluorescence and filled with echoes. Just lately, I've had an extremely bad dream. It recurs. It's like no other dream I've ever had, but somehow it's like all of them. As if it were the sum of all bad dreams. And I wake up feeling bad, as if it wasn't a dream at all, but a vision. I know how crazy that must sound. What is it? It's a man, Bateman said quietly. At least I think it's a man. He's standing on the roof of a high building, or maybe it's a cliff that he's on. It's near sunset, but he's looking the other way, east. Sometimes he seems to be wearing blue jeans and a denim jacket, but more often he's in a robe with a cowl. I can never see his face, but I can see his eyes. He has red eyes, and I have a feeling that he's looking for me, and that sooner or later he will find me. It's more than a feeling, it's a premonition. Sooner or later he will find me, or I will be forced to go to him, and that will be the death of me. That's when you wake up? Yes. They watched Kojak come trotting back, and Bateman patted him while Kojak nosed in the aluminum dish and cleaned up the last of the pound cake. Well, it's just a dream, I suppose, Bateman said. He stood up. If I were being psychoanalyzed, I suppose the shrink would say the dream expresses my unconscious fear of some leader or leaders who will start the whole thing going again. Maybe a fear of technology in general. But this dream, it preys on me, Stu. Stu said nothing. Well, I want to get back, Bateman said briskly. I'm halfway drunk already, and I believe there will be thunder showers this afternoon. He walked to the back of the clearing and rummaged there. A few moments later, he came back with a wheelbarrow. He screwed the piano stool down to its lowest elevation, put it in, added his palette, the picnic cooler, and balanced precariously on top of everything else his mediocre painting. You wheeled that all the way out here? Stu asked. I wheeled it until I saw something I wanted to paint. I go different ways on different days. It's good exercise. If you're going to eat, why don't you come back to Woodsville and spend the night at my house? We can take turns wheeling the barrow, and I've got yet another six-pack of beer cooling in yonder stream. That ought to get us home in style. I accept, Stu said. Good man. I'll probably talk all the way home. You are in the arms of the garrulous professor, East Texas. When I bore you, just tell me to shut up. I won't be offended. I like to listen, Stu said. Then you are one of God's chosen. Let's go. So they walked on down 302, one of them wheeling the barrow while the other drank a beer. No matter which was which, Bateman talked, an endless monologue that jumped from topic to topic with hardly a pause. Kojak bounced alongside. Stu would listen for a while, then his thoughts would trail off for a while, following their own tangents, and then his mind would come back. He was disquieted by Bateman's picture of 100 little enclaves of people, some of them militaristic, living in a country where thousands of doomsday weapons had been left around like a child's set of blocks. But oddly, the thing that his mind kept returning to was Glenn Bateman's dream, the man with no face on top of the high building or the cliff edge, the man with the red eyes, his back to the setting sun, looking restlessly to the east. He woke up sometime before midnight, bathed in sweat, afraid he had screamed. But in the next room, Glenn Bateman's breathing was slow and regular, undisturbed, and in the hallway he could see Kojak sleeping with his head on his paws. Everything was picked out in moonlight, so bright it was surreal. When he woke, Stu had been up on his elbows, and now he lowered himself back to the damp sheet and put an arm over his eyes, not wanting to remember the dream, but helpless to avoid it. He had been in Stovington again. Elder was dead. Everyone was dead. The place was an echoing tomb. He was the only one alive, and he couldn't find the way out. At first he tried to control his panic. Walk, don't run, he told himself over and over. But soon he would have to run. His stride was becoming quicker and quicker, and the urge to look back over his shoulder and make sure that it was only the echoes behind him was becoming insuperable. He walked past closed office doors with names written in black on milky frosted glass, past an overturned gurney, past the body of a nurse with her white skirt rucked up to her thighs, her blackened, grimacing face staring at the cold, white, inverted ice cube trays that were the ceiling fluorescents. At last he began to run. Faster and faster, the door slipping by him and gone, his feet pounding on the linoleum. Orange arrows oozing on white cinder block. Signs. At first they seemed right. radiology, and corridor B to labs, and do not proceed beyond this point without valid pass. And then he was in another part of the installation, a part he had never seen and had never been meant to see. The paint on these walls had begun to peel and flake. Some of the fluorescents were out, others buzzed like flies caught in a screen. Some of the frosted glass office windows were shattered, and through the stellated holes he had been able to see wreckage and bodies in terrible positions of pain. There was blood. These people had not died of the flu. These people had been murdered. Their bodies had sustained punctures and gunshots and traumas. Their eyes bulged and stared. He plunged down a stopped escalator and into a long dark tunnel lined with tile. At the other end there were more offices, but now the doors were painted dead black. The arrows were bright red. The fluorescents buzzed and flickered. The signs read, "This way to cobalt urns," and "Laser armory," and "Sidewinder missiles," and "Plague room." Then, sobbing with relief, he saw an arrow pointing around a right-angled turn with the single blessed word above it, "Exit." He went around the corner and the door was standing open. Beyond it was the sweet, fragrant night. He plunged toward the door and then, stepping into it, a man in jeans and a denim jacket. Stu skidded to a stop, a scream locked in his throat like rusty iron. As the man stepped into the glow of the flickering fluorescence, Stu saw that there was only a cold black shadow where his face should have been, a blackness punched by two soulless red eyes. No soul, but a sense of humor. There was that, a kind of dancing, lunatic glee. The dark man put out his hands, and Stu saw that they were dripping blood. "Heaven and earth," the dark man whispered from that empty hole where his face should have been. "All of heaven and earth." Stu had awakened. Now Kojak moaned and growled softly in the hall. His paws twitched in his sleep, and Stu supposed that even dogs dreamed. It was a perfectly natural thing, dreaming, even an occasional nightmare. But it was a long time before he could get back to sleep. Chapter 30. Lloyd Henreid was down on his knees. He was humming and grinning. Every now and then he would forget what he had been humming, and the grin would fade and he would sob a little bit. And then he would forget he was crying and go on humming. The song he was humming was "Camptown Races." Every now and then, instead of humming or sobbing, he would whisper, "Doo-da, doo-da," under his breath. The holding cell block was utterly quiet except for the humming, the sobbing, the occasional doo-da, and the soft scrape of the cot leg as Lloyd fumbled with it. He was trying to turn Trask's body around so he could get at the leg. "Please, waiter, bring me some more of that coleslaw and another leg." Lloyd looked like a man who had embarked upon a radical crash diet. His prison coverall hung on his body like a limp sail. The last meal served in the holding cell block had been lunch 8 days ago. Lloyd's skin was stretched tightly across his face, limning every curve and angle of the skull beneath. He looked crazy. "Doo-da, doo-da," Lloyd whispered as he fished with his cot leg. Once upon a time, he hadn't known why he had bothered hurting his fingers to unscrew the damn thing. Once upon a time, he had thought he had known what real hunger was. That hunger had been nothing but a slight edge to the appetite when compared with this. "Ride around all night, ride around all day, doo-da." The cot leg snagged the cuff of Trask's pants leg and then pulled free. Lloyd put his head down and sobbed like a child. Behind him, tossed indifferently in one corner, was the skeleton of the rat he had killed in Trask's cell on June 29th, 5 days ago. The rat's long pink tail was still attached to the skeleton. Lloyd had tried repeatedly to eat the tail, but it was too tough. Almost all the water in the toilet bowl was gone, despite his efforts to conserve it. The cell was filled with the reek of urine. He had been peeing out into the corridor so not to contaminate his water supply. He had eaten the food he had squirreled away too fast. He knew that now. He had thought someone would come. He hadn't been able to believe. He didn't want to eat Trask. The thought of eating Trask was horrible. Just last night, he had managed to slap one of his slippers over a cockroach and had eaten it alive. He had felt it scuttering madly around inside his mouth just before his teeth had crunched it in two. Actually, it hadn't been half bad, much more tasty than the rat. No, he didn't want to eat Trask. He didn't want to be a cannibal. It was like the rat. He would get Trask over within reaching distance. But just in case. Just in case. He had heard a man could go a long time without food as long as he had water. Not much water, but I won't think about that now. Not just now. No, not just now. He didn't want to die. He didn't want to starve. He was too full of hate. The hate had built up at a fairly leisurely pace over the last 3 days, growing with his hunger. He supposed that if his long-dead pet rabbit had been capable of thought, it would have hated him in the same way. Lloyd's hate had coalesced around a simple imagistic concept, and this concept was the key. He was locked in. Once upon a time, it had seemed right that he should be. He was one of the bad guys. Not a really bad guy. Poke had been the really bad guy. Small shit was the worst he would have done without Poke. Still, he shared a certain amount of the blame. He supposed he deserved to take a fall, do a little time. It wasn't something you volunteered for, but when they had you cold, they gave you the bullet and you ate it. Like he had told the lawyer, he thought he deserved about 20 for his part in the tri-state kill spree. Not the electric chair. Christ, no. The thought of Lloyd Henry riding the lightning was just... Oh, it was crazy. But they had the key. That was the thing. They could lock you up and do what they wanted with you. In the last 3 days, Lloyd had vaguely begun to grasp the symbolic, talismanic power of the key. The key was your reward for playing by the rules. If you didn't, they could lock you up. It was no different than the go-to-jail card in Monopoly. And with the key went certain prerogatives. They could take away 10 years of your life, or 20, or 40. They could hire people like Mathers to beat on you. They could even take away your life in the electric chair. But having the key didn't give them the right to go away and leave you locked up to starve. It didn't give them the right to force you into eating a dead rat and to try to eat the dry ticking of your mattress. There were certain things you just couldn't do to people. Having the key only took you so far and no further. They had left him here to die a horrible death when they could have let him out. He wasn't a mad dog killer who was going to waste the first person he saw, in spite of what the papers had said. Small shit was the worst he had ever gotten into before meeting Poke. So he hated. For a while, it had seemed to him that the hate was a useless thing, because all of those who had the key had succumbed to the flu. They were beyond the reach of his vengeance. Then, little by little, as he grew hungrier, he realized that the flu wouldn't kill them. It would kill the losers like him. It would kill Mathers, but not that scumbag screw who had hired Mathers, because the screw had the key. It wasn't going to kill the governor or the warden. The guard who said the warden was sick had obviously been a fucking liar. It wasn't going to kill the POs, the county sheriffs, or the FBI agents. The flu wouldn't be able to touch those who had the key. But Lloyd would touch them. If he lived long enough to get out of here, he would touch them plenty. The cot leg snagged in Trask's cuff again. "Come on," Lloyd whispered. "Come on, come on over here. Camptown ladies, sing this song. All do da day." Trask's body slid slowly, stiffly, along the floor of his cell. No fisherman ever played a bonita more carefully or with greater wile than Lloyd played Trask. Once Trask's trousers ripped, and Lloyd had to hook on in a new place. But at last his foot was close enough so that Lloyd could reach through the bars and grab it, if he wanted to. "Nothing personal," he whispered to Trask. He touched Trask's leg. He caressed it. "Nothing personal. I ain't gonna eat you, old buddy. Not less I have to." He was not even aware that he was salivating. Lloyd heard someone in the ashy afterglow of dusk, and at first the sound was so far away and so strange, the clash of metal on metal, that he thought he must be dreaming. The waking and sleeping states had become very similar to him now. He crossed back and forth across that boundary almost without knowing it. But then the voice came, and he snapped upright on his cot, his eyes flaring wide, huge and lambent in his starved face. The voice came floating down the corridors from God knew how far up in the administration wing.
Hoo-hoo! Anybody home?
And strangely, Lloyd's first thought was, don't answer. Maybe he'll go away.
Anybody home? Going once? Going twice? Okay, I'm on my way, just about to shake the dust of Phoenix from my boots.
At that, Lloyd's paralysis broke. He catapulted off the cot, snatched up the cot leg, and began to beat it frantically on the bars. The vibrations raced up the metal and shivered in the bones of his clenched fist.
No!
He screamed.
No, don't go! Please don't go!
The voice, closer now, coming from the stairway between administration and this floor.
We'll eat you up, we love you so. And oh, someone sounds so hungry.
There was a lazy chuckle. Lloyd dropped the cot leg on the floor and wrapped both hands around the bars of the cell door. Now he could hear the footfall somewhere up in the shadows, clocking steadily up the hall that led to the holding cell block. Lloyd wanted to burst into tears of relief. But it was not joy, but fear he felt in his heart, a growing dread that made him wish he had stayed silent. Stayed silent? My God! What could be worse than starvation? Of course, there was no great hurry, because the barred gates at the head of the cell block were shut, and with the power off, the push buttons wouldn't work. His rescuer would have to go back and find the key. He would have to... Lloyd grunted as the electric motor which operated the barred gates whined into life. The silence of the cell block magnified the sound, which ceased with the familiar click-slam of the gates locking open. Then the steps were clocking steadily up the cell block walkway. Lloyd was standing at his cell door again. Now he involuntarily fell back two steps. He dropped his gaze to the floor outside, and what he saw first was a pair of dusty cowboy boots with pointed toes and run-down heels, and his first thought was that Polk had a pair like that. The boots stopped in front of his cell. His gaze rose slowly, taking in the faded jeans snugged down over the boots, the leather belt with the brass buckle, various astrological signs inside a pair of concentric circles, the jeans jacket with a button pinned to each of the breast pockets, a smile face on one, a dead pig, and the words, "How's your pork?" on the other. At the same instant, Lloyd's eyes reluctantly reached Randall Flagg's darkly flushed face. Flagg screamed, "Boo!"